89.3 4CRB.
And a very good morning to you. John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, back with you for another program of The Law and You this Tuesday morning. Your opportunity to get free legal advice between now and 10 o'clock. All you need to do is get on that telephone as soon as you possibly can. 55208888 is the number. That number again, 55208888. And as we say every week, if you're south of the Tweed River, don't forget to put 07 in front of the number. Otherwise, north of the river, you'll get straight through. And as I've been saying, for the last couple of weeks, it's my very great pleasure to welcome to the studio this morning Alex Wynn, also from the Bell Legal Group. And Alex's area of expertise is family law, and we occasionally get questions in that area, so I thought it was a very appropriate opportunity to bring Alex along and give you the opportunity to ask any particular questions on family law that you may have. So a very big welcome, Alex.
Thanks very much, John. Thanks for having me today. The questions we might look at answering about family law could be anything from divorce to property settlement to arrangements for children, including grandchildren. So let me have the calls and we'll see where we go from there.
That's absolutely right. But of course, please don't think that just because Alex is in the studio today and we're focusing on family law today doesn't mean that you can't ring with any other questions you may have. But hopefully we'll get a number of calls on family law. But in the meantime, if you have any questions at all, just get on that telephone, 55208888. Alex, one issue we were talking about before we went on air today, and it was brought into high relief after a conversation I had with one of my nephews last weekend, was the issue about grandparents' rights to see grandchildren. It seems to be an area where there's a lot of confusion. People need to know what their rights are.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting area, and the law was changed some time ago now to specifically reference grandparents as people who can apply for parenting orders for children. Now, a parenting order is the type of court order that's made by a judge that says you can spend time with these children, and the other parents then have to provide those children to make that time. Sometimes, of course, you end up with a situation where there's been a family split and the partner who has the children with them prevents the grandparents from seeing children. And it's very sad. So the law was changed so that grandparents are one of those classes of people who can make their own application if they can't reach an agreement. Look, I'd always advocate in the first instance to try and approach the other party and do things sensibly without involving a lengthy legal process. But if you do end up in a court battle, you are definitely, providing that there's been a history of a relationship between you and the grandchildren, going to be on a sound footing to make your application.
And I mean, I think it's good that the courts have recognised the importance of grandparents in the life of children, because it is a very key role, particularly in these times when often both parents are working and therefore the time available to the children is less. And so the grandparents, I think, really do in many instances take on a far greater role in the lives of the children, often as babysitters for parents who are working. But you said before that grandparents can apply for parenting orders.
That's right.
Do you think that's a term, parenting orders, that may confuse some grandparents about what their rights are?
I'm sure it can do. Parenting orders is simply the generic term that's used by the Family Law Act. It doesn't simply refer to only parents. It could be a third party. Sometimes the person that might need to apply for orders to spend time with the child, or even for the child to live with them, could be an aunt or an uncle, or even a former de facto partner. If there's a very close relationship between a child and another person, then that person has the right to make an application for orders, which just happen to be called parenting orders, because they relate to the care for the child.
Right.
But grandparents have a specific reference in the Act.
Yes.
I think that was to draw people's attention to the fact that they are a very special class of person in a young child's life. Mm. And I say that as the father of three young boys who spend a lot of time with their grandparents.
Mm.
They get a lot out of that relationship, and I think it should be encouraged.
Absolutely agree with that. We've got a couple of callers online, Alex, so we'll take our first call this morning from George. Hello, George.
Yes.
How are you today?
Yes, good, thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks, George. How can I help?
Okay, a couple of questions. A few years back, we bought a property, me and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for business reasons or whatever, she put her name on the title.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just recently we had a death in the family and there was a complication with the will. So we've decided to put both names on the title.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, how would I go about it and how much would it cost?
So, George, if I understand your question, you purchased a property some time ago, but for business purposes, your wife's name was put on the title only. Is that correct? Is this your principal place of residence?
Yes.
It's your home? Okay, well, if it's your home, your principal place of residence, then there are special provisions. Is the property in Queensland?
Yes.
Okay. There are special provisions under the stamp duty legislation which will permit a half interest in that property to be transferred to you either as joint tenant or as tenants in common, and there will be no stamp duty payable in relation to that transaction, but there will be a registration fee payable to the titles office. So you would have to pay the normal registration fee, but otherwise the transfer would be stamp duty exempt if it's transferred into your joint names equally, either as joint tenant or tenants in common. But George, I would strongly suggest that before you proceed to do that, that you perhaps speak with your accountant about the wisdom or your lawyer as to the wisdom or otherwise of making the change, because often properties are purchased in the name of your spouse because you are the person who's regarded as at risk in your business, and therefore you keep the property in the name of your spouse who's the person who's not at risk, so as to maximise the asset protection in relation to the property.
There's no business anymore.
Okay, all right. Well, if there's no business anymore and there's no likelihood of a claim arising out of the business or from any other source, then, yes, there's probably no reason at all why you couldn't do that. And Alex has just very kindly written down for me here that the current registration fee or lodgement fee for that transfer would be $181.
Okay.
All right, then. And all right. You'd obviously have legal fees involved in the preparation of the transfer, but there's not a great deal of cost involved in doing
that. Which are, roughly?
Look, I would say you'd probably be looking at about $250 to $300.
That sounds about right.
Okay, all right. Is it possible for me to come and see you?
Yes. You wouldn't actually see me, but you would be able to see one of the lawyers in our office in the conveyancing department. That would certainly be possible to do that, George. If you just look up Bell Legal Group and ask for the conveyancing team, they'll be able to assist you with that.
All right. How long would it take to proceed with all this?
Probably take maybe a week.
Okay, all right. Yes. Because my wife, she's in and out of Melbourne with this, as I said before.
Well, the documentation could be done in a matter of hours, George, so it's a fairly straightforward process.
Okay, all right. Thanks for that information. Thank you, John.
Okay, George, no trouble at all. And now I'm not sure that we have Doug on the phone or we have Doe. Doug, do you have Doe? Hello, Doug, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, sorry, Doug. They had your name down as D-O-U-G-H, so I thought you might have been Doug who's in the dough.
Yeah, that dough boy. No, Douglas.
How can we help you today?
Oh, am I talking to John now?
You certainly are, yes.
Oh, g'day. Look, I've just become aware. We've got a property which we've listed, but I've become aware of some requirement which came into being on the 1st of July, or a requirement that pre-existed that date, which changed on the 1st of July, affecting properties where there is a mortgage on settlement, where the buyer can withhold money for the ATO. I just have a very sketchy bit of information about this. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do have an idea what you're talking about. It actually relates to properties that are sold to foreign buyers, and there's a requirement that or if it's a foreign buyer selling, that you get an ATO clearance in order to sell the property. And sometimes there is a requirement to withhold money from the sale price. And I think from memory it's now gone up to 12.5%. Do you know, Alex?
Off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I don't, John.
That's okay. It's not an area that either of us practice in, but I have read some of the information in relation to it. And it does, as I say, depend on who the buyer and who the seller of the property are. So what I would suggest you do in relation to it, Doug, before you proceed to sign any contract in relation to the sale of your property, that you speak to your solicitor in relation to those requirements to make sure that you've got clear in your mind what needs to be done so that you don't run into any difficulties with it at all.
Okay, but it only affects, well, I'm not a foreign seller, so,
yes.
it only affects me if I sell to a foreign buyer.
It could affect you if you sell to a foreign buyer, yes.
Yeah, Doug, I've just been looking. If you go to the ATO's own website, there's a little piece about this under the foreign resident capital gains withholding payments, and I think that's the change that we're talking about.
Yes.
Here.
Okay, is all right. Well, I'll go and look that up. Thanks very much for your help.
Okay then, Doug, all the very best.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Now, Alex, we were also talking earlier in relation to this vexed issue about how much either party may be entitled to in a marriage for a property settlement where the relationship breaks down.
Yeah.
There seems to be a general misconception in many people's minds that regardless of how long or short the relationship may have been, that it's a 50-50 split. But you and I know that's certainly not the case. Perhaps you could give some guidance as to
what that
can be.
You're absolutely right. It is a common misconception that a 50-50 split will be applicable. It's going to involve, for a lawyer to work out what your entitlement would be, it's going to involve them knowing all of the circumstances of the case. However long you've been together is very relevant. Who's contributed what? And I don't mean just in terms of money or property. Sometimes people can be together for a long time and one of the persons, say the husband perhaps, has been the breadwinner throughout the relationship and the wife has stayed at home, looked after the children in the home. As far as the law's concerned now, both of those areas of contribution are considered equal in their own sphere. You've got to weigh up whether or not those contributions are imbalanced, and this is particularly relevant if it's a shorter duration relationship. And perhaps if it's something where perhaps more mature people have got together late in life with pre-existing property, and that relationship hasn't worked out for one reason or another. In those sort of cases, there would be a great disparity in their original contributions, perhaps. And so it wouldn't be fair to serve the purposes of justice and equity, to use the language of the law, it wouldn't be fair that they would then split equally all of the property that they each had. There's a little bit of a process. It used to be described as a four-step process. Now, I'll briefly mention that, if I may. It's not technically correct anymore, but it's very helpful. The four steps are this. Firstly, you've got to find out what it is that you've got. That means scheduling out all of the assets, all of the liabilities, including things like superannuation. Then you need to consider how you've actually acquired that, who's contributed what. And that's where I mentioned previously that the contributions can be things like looking after the children or doing things around the home. The next thing you need to look at is where is everybody at in their life, how old people are, what health conditions they have, are they looking after the children? If the children have left home, are there any other arrangements that are unique to that family? And then the last thing, which is the difficult thing, which is to work out what's just and equitable? What's a fair arrangement? And it's rare that you would ever see a precisely 50-50 split. That's most likely to occur where it's been a long, long relationship and the property has been equally contributed to in terms of efforts within the relationship or in breadwinning. But it's more usual these days, I'm seeing, for there to be a unique percentage figure that's worked out that's applicable to that particular case. So it's wrong to suggest that a short relationship would immediately end up in a 50-50. That's very, very rarely going to be the case. My advice is certainly to go and get legal advice as soon as you can. If you realise that your relationship has come to an end, then get legal advice as quickly as possible about the right steps to take so that you can try to resolve things as amicably as possible, which will be the cheapest option for you.
Well, I suppose the other issue here too, of course, Alex, is that quite often people like to avoid lawyers like the plague because they perceive there's just such a cost involved in using a lawyer. And often what can happen is that rather than getting advice at that breakdown point and getting some sound advice about what your circumstances might be, they start talking to each other. And, one party may say, oh, look, I want 60% and you'll get 40%. And one party says, okay, we'll agree to that. But then later they get advice and they realise that 60% is far more than they really should be contributing. But of course, once that commitment's been made and they've said that they're going to give a certain percentage, it's very hard to get the other side of the equation to then pull back from that position. And they've got it set in their mind, haven't they, that I'm getting 60%.
I think from a psychological point of view, that's absolutely right. Mm. But from a legal perspective, unless you've finalised your property settlement with your ex-partner formally, then you leave the door open for them to come back at that in the future. Now, there's a couple of ways that you can formalise these things. One's through a set of court orders, and that doesn't mean rushing off to court and having a fight, but it means scheduling out the deal and then sending that off to the court for approval, and your solicitor can help you with drafting that. The other way to do it is using what's called a financial agreement, which is very similar. You set out the deal in a special type of contract where you each have to be advised independently. The benefit of doing those types of final settlements are, apart from anything else, should you be transferring property, some real estate, say, you have a specific exemption from paying stamp duty on that transfer. Now, whilst you might cavil a little bit about paying solicitor's fees, and I understand that, it can seem like an expensive process, but it's an awful lot cheaper to spend some money on your solicitor's fees than to pay unnecessary stamp duty that comes out of that.
Or worse still, to pay far more, to agree to pay far more to your spouse than you needed to agree to. That could be very expensive.
Well, that's right. Mm. You're talking about property settlements. If they are, when you add up real estate, superannuation, monies in bank, investments, properties, cars, anything that can have a value ascribed to it goes into that property pool. And imagine what 1% of all of that is worth. So it's certainly worth getting professional help to get the best deal possible for you. It can save you many, many thousands of dollars.
Quite agree. We have Anne online. Anne, good morning. How are you today?
I'm well. Yourself?
Very well indeed. Thanks. How can we help you today?
Yes, it's a question regarding small business.
Sure.
Yeah, my partner has a small business.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me the other day, well, if he passes away suddenly, just keep operating the business. And I said, well, you can't do that. I said, if somebody passes away, because the business isn't my, I'm not a partner in the business, it automatically goes to the estate. Is that correct, or is other ways around it that we can handle this situation?
Well, it depends on how the business is owned, Anne. So if the business is simply operated by your partner as a sole trader, then yes, there are potentially some issues there because if, for example, the bank accounts are in his name there are other accounts, et cetera, that are in his name, there can be difficulty because at the point that he dies, the person who then takes over looking after things, hopefully has a will, is the executor.
Yes, yes.
But there may be problems in operating on the bank account after he's passed away because the bank very well may require probate of the will in order to allow someone new to operate on the bank account. So they're the sorts of issues that you can potentially face. One of the ways around that would be to operate through a company, and your partner could be the sole director of the company, but both you and your partner could be shareholders in the company, so that on his passing, you as the surviving shareholder, and if his shares are left to you under the will, could resolve to appoint yourself as a director so that you can immediately take over the operation of the business, which would limit the prospect of there being difficulty in continuing to trade and continuing to pay bills, etc. The other alternative might be if you were a signatory on the bank account also, but of course the difficulty with that is that if the bank became aware that he has passed away before you've gone through the process of being able to get probate of the will, if that's what's required in order to change the bank account, if the bank became aware of his of your partner's passing, then they may freeze the bank account anyway. So what you really need to do, Anne, I think, is get some sound advice from your accountant and your solicitor, if necessary, for any changes that are required, so that you can put in place a process that will ensure that in the event of anything happening to your partner, you can continue on.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. No, much appreciated that input, you know, and we'll certainly look into probably forming a company in that respect.
Yes.
And he's the director, and he can make the various decisions in that respect. But, yeah, I really appreciate that input, and at least I know which direction to go now.
Good on you, Anne. All the very best. And we say a very good morning to Frank. Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
How can we help you today, Frank?
Oh, listen, this is to do with legal costs. My son is in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and he and his partner have separated. He's in West Australia, she's here. We've engaged a local firm to do the settlement, and the only asset that is involved is his superannuation in the Navy and her little bit of superannuation.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had one session in the federal court where I acted on his behalf, and we agreed on a 60-40 split.
Mm-hmm.
To date, the matter is still not fully resolved. The legal costs in just the sorting out of those assets is over $35,000 for the son. And almost every week, if there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, he's asked for another $1,000.
Mm.
I think this is getting to the point of being ridiculous.
Mm. Well, Frank, I'll hand that over to Alex to give you his views on that.
Yeah, Frank, it's radio, so you couldn't see my eyebrows lifting, but it does sound rather like a lot of money for what should be a fairly straightforward process.
It was a very straightforward process. I negotiated it on his behalf in about 30 minutes. That's all that was involved.
So, Frank, with the appearance that you've had in the Federal Circuit Court, I'm guessing up in Brisbane there.
Yes.
We can't mention names, I'm afraid, because you're not allowed to publish those with ongoing things. But you've negotiated with the partner, and you've agreed a 60-40 split, and that happened on the day of court, the first mention date?
Absolutely. We didn't even need to go into court, and the solicitor said, oh, well, that's fine. We'll just get somebody to review exactly the amounts and file an application for court. You don't need to do that,
but look, I don't want to step on another practitioner's toes where there could be complexities I don't know of. But typically,
there's no complexities at all, other than there was a small amount of my son's another job of $2,000 that was found, and that it had to be an adjustment made to the amount of the payer.
Yes.
Now that's cost an extra. That the amount involved is $2,000. The legal cost for that adjustment is over $4,000.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
I know.
One has to keep a very commercial eye with these things so that property settlement costs don't outstrip the benefit of doing it in the first place.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no property, there's no houses or anything involved. It's pretty, I would have thought, pretty simple
I couldn't imagine there would be a necessity for a further application to be made. Look, if somebody comes to me in those circumstances, the way which I'd approach it is that if you have started a case, that means it's contested to start with. So there's time spent on the preparing of affidavits and initiating applications and so forth, and that can be quite time consuming. Once that's done, and the matter goes before court, there's time involved at court and the negotiation where the solicitor's present as well. There's going to be time and expense involved there. Once you've reached that conclusion, though, what would typically occur, and I've done this on many occasions, is that you draft a set of what are called consent orders. Those consent orders would include reference to the superannuation company or companies, the trustees usually. That document then needs to be served upon the superannuation company so that they're given what's called procedural fairness, because they're not in the case, so they need to be made aware of it before the judge will make those orders.
Yep.
But if you've already reached the concluded settlement, the process of settling consent orders, there can be a little bit of back and forth, and occasionally the trustees may want to change the wording slightly for their own reasons internally. But there is not a great deal of time that's then spent after the settlement of the consent orders, because it's really then just an administrative procedure waiting for the approval to come back and then filing those in court. And if you've indicated to the judge on your day in court that you've reached an arrangement, then it's quite common for that judge to say that, well, you can simply send them through to me in chambers and I'll make those orders, providing I've received, you know, written representations to say it's a fair arrangement to make justice and equity I was talking about before. But, you know, the $35,000 figure does sound, dare I say, a little on the high side from my experience, but I can't speak to your particular case, of course.
Mm. And we accepted there was a, you know, $20,000 up front before we got there.
Mm.
But look, his estimate to us to complete the thing was maybe $500 or $1,000. We're now over $3,000 and heading, and he wants another $1,000 for the final bit. And I think at this stage, I'm at the hairs on the back of my head are standing up.
Frank, which part of the Gold Coast do you live on?
Well, I live up north at the Paradise Point Runaway Bay.
Right, okay. Because what I was going to suggest you may be able to do would be to take the documentation you've got, including the tax invoices, etc., either into the Citizens Advice Bureau at Southport. You'd have to ring them to make a time to go in and see them. Their number is 553-29611.
Thank you.
553-29611. Or if you happen to be down at Robina on a Thursday evening, bear in mind they have late night shopping there from 6:30 until 8:30, you can go to the Robina Community Legal Centre and you could possibly show them the documentation and ask them to express an opinion in relation to the tax invoices, etc., because there is a process to have those reviewed. If you don't agree with them, first of all, there needs to be a costs agreement because the costs are over $1,500. And if the estimates in the cost agreement are exceeded, then you need to be given a variation and accept a variation in relation to those costs. But even with all of that, the costs still have to be fair and reasonable, and there is a process for review. So I would suggest in the first instance either go to the Citizens Advice Bureau or the community Robina Community Legal Centre and have them have a look at them for you.
I will definitely do that. The only problem I have at the moment, my son is in the Navy and he's on a ship in the Middle East.
Yep.
And it's difficult for him to communicate, for me to get that information quickly because I haven't received the invoices.
I
don't hold them.
Right, okay.
I will send to him and he makes the payments. When he gets to shore, he makes the payments by the internet. But the communication process is difficult because he's in a war zone.
Yes.
He doesn't have normal access to normal communication.
Yes. Well, look, I doubt that the lawyers are going to give you copies of their tax invoices unless you have authority from your son. So if your son could simply send you or send the lawyers an email saying, I authorise you to give all such documents as my father may request to him, that might be a way that you can get hold of those copies, and then at least from there you can then follow that process I suggest and look at whether you should be taking further steps to have the costs reviewed. All right,
thank you, your advice. I really appreciate your advice. You've been very, very helpful.
No trouble at all, Frank.
We should have come to you first.
Oh, well.
Other than the company
what do they say about hindsight?
Well, it's one of those cases, Frank, of 2020 hindsight, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Good luck, Frank.
Bye now. Now, we still have Nancy on the line, but unfortunately we're going to quickly press up to the 10 o'clock news, Nancy. So if you don't mind just staying on the line, we'll take that call as soon as we get off air. Alex, thank you very much for coming in today. That's certainly been most interesting. A couple of quite interesting calls on family law and, of course, some other great information we've been able to share.
Yes, thanks very much for having me in today, John.
This is John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group. Until next week, as always, goodbye and God bless.